Welcome, friends. This is another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program on economic events and analysis that comes to you through the workings of the Pacifica Network and many other affiliated stations. My name is Richard Wolff. I've been an economics professor all my adult life. I am the host of Economic Update. Currently, I teach as visiting professor at the New School University in New York City. This is a program that I've put together designed to provide economic analysis of the current developments, both here in the United States, but also globally, because the global economy now shapes everything that happens in the United States more than ever. I want to also draw your attention to a remarkable daily source of news and analysis, Truthout. You can find their independent and courageous work every day at truthout.org. And I urge you to check them out. Please also know that you can follow the kinds of work you see on this program, you hear on this program, at two websites that I maintain where all the work we do is elaborated, and you can see often the sources of it. The first one is rdwolf with two Fs.com, and the other one is democracyatwork.info. Either or both of those websites will provide you with a kind of continuation of what we do on the program. Finally, let me ask you to again keep flowing in with your comments and your questions through email. You can find the email connection to send your ideas either on rdwolf.com or on democracyatwork.info. Use the websites as a way of letting us know what you're interested in. We answer some on each program towards the end, but we use all of your communications to shape these programs. I want to begin our economic update for this week by picking up on two stories that we dealt with last week, but there have been further developments. We talked a little bit briefly last week about the Philadelphia school system, where I noted the extraordinary desperation that in order to have enough money for basic school activities next year, the current superintendent of schools went to the state legislatures and begged for money and offered in exchange to abrogate the seniority rules for teachers. An extraordinary move, I thought. Well, I also learned last week that thousands of high school students in Philadelphia walked out of the public schools in protest against the austerity programs imposed by the governor, imposed by the legislature on the city of Philadelphia, the largest city in Pennsylvania, savaging their public school system. You may remember that we also spoke last week about the closing of many schools in Chicago by the mayor there. And I wanted to add something, which is a context for all of this. We live in a society in which we currently have 20 to 25 million unemployed people. According to the Federal Reserve, we have about 20% of our capacity to produce unused tools, equipment, factory store, office space, sitting idle. We can't put together, as a capitalist economic system, the millions of people who want to work with all the tools and raw materials they need to produce. And if we gave these people the job they need and want, using the raw materials and tools that are sitting there and available, we could produce a kind of wealth in our society that could solve many of our social problems, including, for example, keeping our schools open. But we don't do that. We fail as an economic system to do it, and then we punish those amongst us who are the most vulnerable, like high school students in our urban areas, by cutting back on the programs for them. And at the same time, the people at the top become wealthier and wealthier. It's a stunning story. And that's the way to understand what's happening in school systems across the country. The other story I want to pick up from last week has to do with the Apple Corporation. If you recall, we went through the public testimony that Apple was required to give in Congress, revealing that they had used every tax gimmick available under the law to minimize their tax payments. And they did this by moving the location of where their profits show up, since they have subsidiaries in many countries. They can arrange to have the profits show up in any of those countries simply by making invoices from one subsidiary to another. These are accounting arrangements. And many of the corporations, like Apple, have been using Ireland for many years because the tax rate on corporations in Ireland is much lower than it is in many other countries, much lower, for example, than the United States. And I wanted to make two points. One, that Apple is not the only corporation. Many, many others do it. There were clear revelations in recent times that Google has been doing it and Starbucks has been doing it and so on. So there's nothing unique about Apple. This is a normal corporate effort. And I wanted to put it in a context of what we call globalization. Because globalization has meant corporations have been doing two things of great importance over the last 20 years. Number one, moving production to where they can make the most profits, typically where the wages are lowest. Moving to India, moving to China, moving to Brazil, and so on, to achieve through globalization the cheapest possible way to produce. But the second part of globalization has been having gotten more profits by producing where you can pay low wages, the trick has also been make sure the profits show up where you will pay the least taxes on them. So people like Apple produce in Asia, where the wages are lowest, and have the profits show up in Ireland, in the West, where the taxes are lowest. In this way, they can pay less to workers and less to governments and keep more for themselves as profits for the company, dividends for the shareholders, huge salaries for the top executives, and so on. This has been going on for a long time internationally, but it has also been going on inside the United States. And here's how it works. Companies like Apple or Google or Starbucks or hundreds of others play one state off against another, one city off against another. They go to a state and say, well, we have a factory here, but we're leaving to go to, I don't know, let's pick one, Nebraska, because Nebraska is giving us a better deal. Why don't you make it worth our while not to go to Nebraska by doing one better than Nebraska, giving us a tax holiday for a longer number of years, building a road where we want it, giving us a subsidy to pay workers less because you will kick in to the workers what we don't pay them. There's lots of gimmicks. And they do the same thing with cities. We're leaving Newark and we're going to Trenton, unless, of course, Newark makes it worth our while not to go to Trenton, or we've been talked to Jackson, Mississippi, and we'll see whether they... And the end result of all of this is, it's called a race to the bottom. By playing everybody off, city after city has to give more to company and tax them less. State after state has to do the same. Governments have to do the same. It's extraordinary. And to give you one measure of the outcome, I thought I would pick up on a story in the New York Times on May 29th by Eduardo Porter. And he gives a little statistic to show you how this worked by comparing the situation at the end of the 1940s, the end of World War II, and today, 2010 to be exact. The end of the 1940s, the individual income tax in the United States was roughly 40% of the total federal income, federal taxes for Washington. 40% came from individuals, 40% came from taxes on corporations. Now let's fast forward to 2010. The amount of federal revenue coming from individuals, income tax, has gone up to 45%. Gone up from 40% in the 1940s to 45% now. What about corporations? Well, here's the result. In the 1940s, as I mentioned, corporations contributed 40% of what Washington took in. In 2010, corporations contributed 10% of what Washington took in. There's the result of playing these tax games, moving production out of the country, moving your profits to where you can pay lower rates, and depriving the United States of that tax money, with the result that either everybody else has to make up for what the corporations don't pay, or we cut services like screwing the children of Philadelphia out of the education they need and our future economy likewise. The next update, a new one, is rare for me. I want to give a celebration, a praise, to an American politician. The one in question, Alan Grayson. He He is the Democratic representative of Florida's 9th District, serving in Congress, and he's just introduced a bill I want to mention here on the air. It's called House of Representatives Bill Number 2096. It's called the Paid Vacation Act. Here is the daring initiative of Congressman Grayson. He would like to make it the law in the United States that all fully employed workers have at least 1 week of mandated paid vacation per year. He wants that to be the law. He's being fought by chambers of commerce and all kinds of business and conservative groups. I just thought you'd like to know that in most industrial countries of Europe, for example, they have 4 weeks of paid vacation. That is the law. In some countries, like France, 5 weeks of paid vacation is the law. This is not something that depends on a contract negotiated between a union and an employer. It's not something that depends on the goodwill of an employer. It's the law. Here in the United States, fully one quarter of our workers have no paid vacations at all. Three quarters have paid vacations, but they can be as little as 3 or 4 days, or they can be more depending on what either a union has won or what an employer has chosen to give. The point is to make it necessary. And the point is particularly to help those at the bottom 25% of our labor force, who have no paid vacations at this point at all. So congratulations to Congressman Grayson. He would like to bring the United States out of the medieval approach to paid vacations that it has, unlike that of any other advanced industrial country, and he deserves credit for taking the initiative to do that. Next short update I want to deal with is something called the Cadillac tax. This is an important part of the Obamacare legislation that was passed and is now being implemented. But this is a very bad piece of legislation. Here's what it does. It applies a stiff 40% tax to what are called high-end medical insurance programs for workers. If your employer pays more than about $10,000 for you as an individual and more than about $23,000 or $4,000 for you as part of a family group, the employer is going to have to pay a big tax when this goes into effect, and that's scheduled to happen over the next year or two. And so many employers are beginning to cut back on the quality of the insurance, medical insurance program they provide to their workers, explaining to the workers, we have to do this because otherwise we're going to be subject to this big tax. What was the rationale for such a tax argument? It'll make employers be more vigilant not to have their workers misuse a good medical program by going to the doctor too often, requiring too much care. In other words, in order to reduce the cost of medical care in the United States, the solution found is to tax the employer, forcing or at least pressuring the employer, who doesn't want to pay the tax, to either reduce the coverage that the workers get, so he won't be spending the $10,000 for each worker, or to make the worker pick up more of the cost himself or herself by higher co-pays, by exclusions, by minimal payments that you have to make as an individual. In other words, we're solving the problem of excess medical expenses in America by damaging the quality of medical care and medical insurance that people are actually going to get. These are not the people at the bottom who don't have any coverage at all, or people who are getting very poor coverage. No, this is a targeted program at those who are getting a quality medical program to cut them too. Let's remind ourselves of this basic fact. The United States spends more for medical care than any other advanced industrial country. Way more. We're not even close to the number two. At the same time, the medical outcomes we get as a nation are mediocre. They're in the middle. We don't do better. We don't live longer. We don't have fewer visits to hospitals. We don't have fewer major invasive surgeries. Our results are no better than many other countries. We just spend a lot more. And why? Because we have a medical industrial complex in the United States. four intertwined industries: the doctors, the hospitals, the drug companies, and the medical insurance companies. And they've worked out a cozy arrangement among themselves. They take care of each other really pretty well. The doctors probably the least well, but the others pretty well. And so we end up paying a lot, and we're not getting much. In a free enterprise system, if it's supposed to work like that, we're told when you pay way more than everybody else for something that isn't any better than anything else, the market will fix it. Yeah, well, it hasn't happened yet in the United States. And instead of dealing with this medical industrial complex and what it does to prices, we are slapping those who've gotten a good health care coverage and making it a lot less good. Rather than do more updates, I want to turn now and tell you how pleased I am that I have with me today an old friend, someone that I've worked with for over 40 years. His name is Stanley Aronowitz, and I think it's a name many of you know already. And so I want to begin by welcoming Stanley to the program. Thank you for coming. Let me introduce Stanley to you. He teaches social theory and labor studies at the City University of New York Graduate Center. He is the author of, count them, 26 books. And the latest published book is called Taking It Big, C. Wright Mills and the Making of Political Intellectuals. As usual, he's at work on a new book, and this one has a very provocative title, but the title says it all. Dead Unions, The Birth of a New Labor Movement. It is scheduled to be published by the Verso Publications Company in early 2014. Stanley is a former steel worker and a union organizer for the clothing workers and the oil, chemical, and atomic workers. He was recently a member of the Executive Council and Negotiating Committee of the Professional Staff Congress, which is the City University of New York's union of faculty and staff. So, Stanley, with that kind of a background, I want to start by asking you some questions about organized labor. And the first one I'm asking you because so many people have written in to ask me. Can you, in a short span of time, given our limits, give us your sense of why the reaction of working people in the 1930s, the last time we had a collapse on this magnitude of our economic system, was so different in terms of union organizing, fighting and getting Social Security on unemployment and minimum wage and union recognition law? Why were the working people of America, unionized and not, so different in their response to the Great Depression than they have been in the 5.5 years of the current so-called Great Recession?
I'll give you three reasons. There are many more, but they're the key reasons. The first reason is that at the time of the upsurge, which begins in 1933 and goes on till about 1937, those 4 years where millions of workers were organized, there were no benefits. There was no unions in major industrial sectors, steel, auto, glass, rubber, you name it. And so the fight was really in many ways for the most basic benefits, the most basic issues, which are, do I have any power on the job? Can I get a decent wage? Can I get benefits such as pension and old age insurance, health insurance? The second reason was that there was a left. And that left were communists and socialists and anarchists and independents who were union organizers from way back. Some of them were of the industrial workers of the world. Some of them were within the unions, the established unions. The clothing workers was a socialist union. And there were communists who had been organizing in the 1920s and early 30s. And they were really, in many ways, the spearhead in many of the union organizing campaigns, in auto especially, and mining. The third reason is rather important, which is that this was a period of American history where there was a large immigrant community that did not have to worry about being deported. We had no major laws which said you could be deported for not being a citizen. Yes, there was a immigration restriction enacted in 1920, but it did not really affect the Eastern and Southern European immigrants who came to work in the mines and mills of this country. And so there was less fear. And so the problem of fear today, the problem of some floor of benefits which still exists, government unemployment insurance, and people still have some savings, and people still own, and they own homes, and they have a number of different things, has slowed down the reaction. I'm not saying that this is going to stay for long. The reason it won't stay for long is that unless this economy can supply for the 20 to 25% of the people who are unemployed or underemployed or have walked out of the labor force, there's going to be another upsurge, and it's already beginning to happen. It's not really there yet. So that the problem at this point, I think, is that people are afraid. The people who have jobs are afraid that, as you described in the beginning of this broadcast, they're afraid that if they demand too much, the company will move, not only from Nebraska to or in Pennsylvania, but they'll move overseas. The second reason that they are afraid is that large numbers of immigrants who work in construction, who work in the working poor, they're afraid of being deported. And this administration of Barack Obama is an administration which has deported over 1 million people. That's a very big number. And the third reason, in some respects, is that for fear is that we live in a very uncertain time. There really is a great suspicion out there among many people, working people, professionals as well, that this economy is not really going to revive. And so whatever people have, they're clutching, they're holding on for dear life. And that's slowing down the reaction.
All right, let me pick up on one point that you made, that there was an important role played by socialists and communists. We know that when the New Deal was done and when the war was behind us, a profound campaign was unleashed, starting in the middle, later 40s, to destroy the communist and socialist parties, organizations, movements, and all of that. Do you see that as a response to the role that those people played in the labor upsurge of the 30s?
Absolutely. I mean, they talked about the subservience of the Communist Party to the Soviet Union, but they also did damage to anarchists, people who were in the industrial workers of the world, independent radicals. What they were worried about is that the working class would prevent them from earning their two or three ways of super profits, you know. And although for a section of the working class, there still was a deal, that is to say, there was an agreement, a social compact, as it were. For many others, there was no social compact, and they were going to make sure that social compact became smaller and smaller and smaller and affected fewer and fewer people.
Right. And so that the long-term decline of the labor movement, at least in its membership, that we start seeing sort of a peaking, if I remember, around the 50s, and then a long decline of membership, is, in a sense, the working out of the last step of it. You got rid of the socialists and communists and all the other leftists, and then you went after the labor movement, too, whether it's starting with the Taft-Hartley in 47 or anything that happened later, in a sense, to get rid of the very formations that had made the 1930s so different from what we have today.
That's right. But what was so tragic is that the unions that were the mainstream of the labor movement that benefited from that upsurge of the 1930s, such as the auto workers and the steel workers, collaborated with the government to get rid of the communists. And what they did not recognize or realize is that they themselves were the real target. Not only the communists and the socialists, but they were the target of that attack. And as you said just now, as soon as they got rid of the socialists and the communists, they went after the unions. And they had been going after the unions really in the 1930s. But Taft-Hartley, which was John L. Lewis called it the Slave Labor Act, was an act that prevented unions from engaging in sympathy strikes, from refusing to handle struck goods. For striking, if it was a national emergency, the president had a right to call 80-day cooling off period, et cetera, et cetera. They fell into line. The unions fell into line. And when public employees got organized in the 1960s, now they're more public employees organized than private sector workers. When public employees got organized in the 1960s, they went along with state laws that banned the right to strike, which is a violation of the First Amendment, in my opinion. And, of course, no court agrees with that, because the courts are themselves a product of a certain kind of ideology.
Yeah, so it is very ironic, in a certain sense, that the unions who collaborated with, if I understand your point, with the government in getting rid of socialists and communists, didn't understand that what they were doing was getting rid of one of their own allies, thereby weakening them when the business community went after them, which we now know was the agenda, because long after the socialists and communists were thrown out of the unions in the 40s and 50s, the decline of the labor movement and its victimization at the hands of business strategy has been going on for decades and decades after that without arrest. And the now the unions are bitter and complaining at how small they are, how weak they are, how beleaguered they are. And yet your point is they were complicit in the adjustments after the war that brought this about.
But they're still committed to the two-party system and to the law itself. The law itself, with its Taft-Hartley amendments, that is to say the labor relations law, is not in the union's interest. And they still go to representation elections. They organize a factory in the South or a workplace in the South, and they can win an election, but they can't get a contract. And the reason they can't get a contract is because the administrative law permits the employer from undertaking endless delays. And if you charge them with unfair labor practices under the law, they can delay remedies for many, many moons. Meanwhile, workers have been fired. Meanwhile, the plant has been partially dismantled. Meanwhile, the company has really smashed the internal union activists by forcing them into line.
Well, so let me push you again and ask the same question repeatedly. Why has there been no response? Why have the unions watched their own decline, whether it's the members or the leaders, year after year, decade after decade, faced with this legal situation, faced with the behavior of both political parties in this situation? Why no break from a set of commitments and policies that seem to have had such bad results for so long a time?
Because they are terrified of becoming an independent oppositional force in American society. The few crumbs that they get from the administrations, of especially the Democrats, they hang on to for dear life. They gave $400 million to the Obama campaign in 2012 for both the presidential and the congressional campaign in the vain hope that somehow, by electing Democrats, they will be benefited by an improved labor relations law, by an improved labor relations board. But the main internal reason is that there's no, or very little, there's not no, but there's very little boiling from below. They used to be in the 60s and 70s, and to a large extent in the Teamsters until the 90s, they used to be rank and file movements that push the unions, at least movements that said, if you don't do the right thing, we're going to take power. Those movements have basically declined very seriously, because you don't expect the labor leadership or the Democratic Party to do anything right. What you expect is that if they are pressured from below, the electorate in the case of the parties and the rank and file in the case of the unions, they may respond with some fight. The fact of the matter is that they, having crushed their own opposition and their own opposition having failed to mobilize sufficiently, they have no reason to do anything but preserve themselves in power. And what we are looking at now is a bureaucracy that may make noises about being oppositional or changing, but basically they don't have the means, they don't have the intelligence, they don't have the basic base, the political base to be able to change themselves.
Before we take our mid-program break, one quick question, push you for a quick answer. If I hear you correctly, we are then observing a labor movement where it now represents under 7% of workers in the private sector. You're then watching a labor movement stuck in a way of relating itself to the law, to the political parties, watching itself disappear.
Yes, because they have decided, Richard, they have decided that they will depend on the Democratic Party rather than on their own resources. They have virtually given up organizing. There are several places where they are organizing. Car washes in New York City just got organized. But basically, they've given up organizing in favor of political electoral action. And that is a disaster because the Democratic Party is a center-right party. It is not a pro-labor party anymore.
We're going to take a short break at this point in the middle of our program, as we often do. I'm talking with Stanley Aronowitz about the American labor movement, past and present. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. Please come back after this short break, and we will continue this conversation.
Will you win? It's your show now. So what's it gonna be? Cause people will tune in. How many train wrecks do we need to see before we lose touch? Oh, and we thought this was low. Well, it's bad, getting worse. So where'd all the good people go? I've been changing channels, I don't see them on the TV shows. Where'd all the good people go? We got heaps and heaps of what we sow. They got this and that with a rattle-a-tat test and one, two. Now what you gonna do? Bad news, missed news, got too much to lose. Give me some truth, now whose side are we on? Whatever you say, turn on the boob tube. I'm in the mood to obey, so lead me astray.
Okay, welcome back. Dear friends, I'm talking with Stanley Aronowitz, professor at the City University of New York, author, specialist on the labor movement, writing a book right now, what he calls Dead Unions and the Birth of a New Labor Movement here in the United States. Okay, let's turn from the analysis of the past to what you think is the possibility for the future. If unions are in the tough shape that you've just described for us, what is the basis for whatever optimism you have as to what is possible now and what would have to happen to realize such possibilities?
Well, one of the things that is happening now is that in Walmart and fast food restaurants, workers are starting to organize and strike without any prospect of a union contract. That means that they are taking on a very old tactic of the labor movement of the pre-New Deal period, which is that you didn't have a law, you didn't have a contract, you struck, and when the employer caved and gave an increase or gave a benefit or changed the working conditions by putting in an air conditioner or something like that, then you went back to work. What happened under the law is that the law convinced unions that what they needed was a contract that guaranteed, that sealed in all those benefits, as especially on the wage front. And what happened then is that the strike weapon began to decline. And now we have almost no strikes within the traditional unions. Not to say that we have none, but almost none. So the first thing that would have to happen is that the unions would have to, that workers would have to say, our objective is not to win a contract. Our objective is to improve our conditions. The second thing that would have to happen in order for the unions to become something else is that they would have to say, look, the worker is not simply somebody who works at the shop or the office floor. The worker is somebody who has housing problems. There are foreclosures all over the country, which only the former Occupy Wall Street groups are taking up. That people have educational problems. Their working class neighborhoods of Philadelphia, of New York, of Los Angeles, of Chicago have terrible, terrible conditions. You have a mayor of the city of Chicago who has closed 54 schools. The unions, the labor movement, would have to take on those struggles. Not just the teachers' union, not just kids, the students, although that's wonderful. but it has to be done by the entire labor movement. And it's still got, you know, 14 million members. It's got tons and tons of money. And it's not mobilizing its membership around the totality of the problems that the membership face. The third thing is that the military budget is draining 50% of our national treasury. And they have said they are against the law, against the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. But they didn't do anything to mobilize on those questions because the military budget is still there. And one of the reasons the unions keep quiet about it after taking a rhetorical position against the war is because many of their members benefit from the military budget. They're afraid to fight the military budget because they don't have the imagination collectively to say, what do we do about the 20% of unused capacity that you described at the beginning of this program? How do we work? Can we establish workers' co-ops? Can we establish workers' control within the workplace? They don't have that perspective. They concede by contract to management, for example, the right to manage the workplace. They concede the right of management to prohibit strikes. You can get very, very seriously fined if you go on a strike during the life of a contract that has a no-strike provision. They haven't taken up those issues, and they're not ready to take up those issues. And therefore, in some way, we need a new labor movement, and it's being suggested by workers who are going on strike regardless whether they have contracts or whether they have a formal apparatus for sealing in their benefits.
Tell me if I can pull this out. If the socialist and communist movements were destroyed after World War II, if the labor movement is in the kind of dire condition that we've been discussing that your work demonstrates, then one might reach the conclusion that in order for the country to change, there has to be a rebirth of all of these things. In other words, there has to be a new version of whatever the socialist and communist left is. There has to be a new birth of a labor movement, either rediscovering old strategies and tactics or developing new ones. But that we're almost at a place where we have to say goodbye to a whole epoch of American history and think about change requiring the birth of a whole new set of organizations and relationships among them.
That's absolutely true. Not only do we need a new political formation of the left, but we need a revival of the reliance on direct action rather than the law. The unions believe the law is holy. It's sanctified as a protection of workers and their conditions. The truth of the matter is the law is against the people. It's against the workers. And until and unless they begin to become at least skeptical and perhaps oppositional to the rule of law and the way in which the law has been applied, then I don't think the labor movement is going anywhere, even if we develop a new labor movement. But beyond that, we need a vision of a good life. What is the good life? It's not enough to fight, as Samuel Gompers, the founder of the AFL, said when he's asked, what is your vision? He said, more. It's not enough. We need a vision. Well, if you don't like the communist vision or the socialist vision or the anarchist vision, then you have to have some kind of vision, because what animates people to stay in the struggle decade after decade after decade is their belief that there's a real alternative. And if the labor movement does not provide the alternative, the left will have to provide the alternative and fight within the labor movement to get that alternative adopted as labor's program. I see this happening in Western Europe as well. The labor movement in Western Europe has become a very staid and, relatively speaking, uninvolved part of the countries. There are exceptions. Greece is one exception. But it is not common. What's happening in the European situation is that they're getting chipped away much more slowly than the United States. Yeah. But they're getting chipped away.
But here's a question about the Europe-America comparison that I'm asked all the time. In Europe, at least, one sees big demonstrations. Rome had one a couple weeks ago. Lisbon has had them. Athens has had so many that we lose track. And around many countries in Europe, there are big demonstrations in which left political parties, the labor movement, independent social movement groups get together either to demand jobs, that is, oppose unemployment, or to fight austerity, or to make all kinds of demand. Why do we see in Europe that kind of mass mobilization? In many ways, the biggest sustained mobilization over the last 3 years that they've had probably since the Second World War. Why do we see that there, and we're still waiting for a big anti-unemployment or anti-austerity march here in the United States, mobilizing comparable social forces?
Well, they have a left. They have political parties of the left. They also have a tradition. They also had, you know, the occupation by the Nazis. They understand the problem that is posed by a militarized state, by an employer class that is obdurate, which is now, in the case of neoliberalism, as resistant to change as anything. In our country, we haven't had a left of any consequence now for about 70 years, I would say 65 years. And that has had a tremendous effect on whether or not we can build the kind of opposition there in the United States. But there's one more thing that I want to say, Richard. I don't think it's a small potato. We have a militarized state in this country, and there's an increasing militarization in Western Europe. What that means is that we cannot expect the possibility of reform to be realized in our country or in Western Europe. We need reform. We have to test the question of reform. But the chances of reform are not as much as they were at the end of the Second World War and even in the 1930s in this country. The question then becomes the one of power. Are the people ready to take power in new forms, with new organizations, new kinds of demands? And that's also true of Western Europe. They could have a general strike in Athens every Monday and Thursday, as my grandmother would say, but they still can't get very far. They're still trying to win elections, and I think that's a mistake.
As we come to the end of our time, let me ask your comment on the following argument, that what is happening in the United States, in Western Europe, and in Japan could be described as follows. Sometime in the 1970s, with the development of modern jet travel, with telecommunications, the internet, and all of that, it became finally feasible technologically and also feasible politically to bring a vast new low-wage working class into global capitalism. The working classes of the colonial or formerly colonial territories, whose experience with colonialism and imperialism had given them wages way below what had been achieved in the United States, Western Europe, and Japan. And capitalists drew the following conclusion. Good. We've made a lot of money by the colonial thing, but we can't have colonies anymore. We've had to pay higher wages to our workers here in the United States and Western Europe, but now we can make much more money by basically leaving the United States and Western Europe and Japan and moving production to China, India, Brazil, etc. around the world, taking advantage of this vast new low-wage working class. And we're going to do it. And they've been doing it. Outsourcing, exporting jobs, whatever you want to call it. First in manufacturing, starting in the 60s and 70s, and in the last 20 years, white-collar work as well. Leaving the working classes of the United States, Western Europe, and Japan to discover that when capitalism moves on, you're left with nothing. You're left with a declining workforce, a declining wages, declining a social sector of the government in terms of benefits.
Social wage.
So that what's happening is what the Western working class was never prepared for, that it is being subject to an end run of the capitalists, saying to them, we're not going to come back and give you good jobs unless and until you offer us a competitive wage, social wage and private wage, to that which we can find in the former colonial territories that are desperate for us to come there to give them a chance to advance. So that we have, in short, a new configuration of the global working class, which is, for the first time, confronting the working classes where capitalism began. Europe, North America, Japan got going first, is now leaving there, and we're just picking up the collapse of that whole history of capitalism.
Except for one thing. the description works, and there are two things. The first thing is China and more recently India is beginning to experience an awakened working class. They are striking. There were 10,000 strikes in 2010 in China. I mean, it's unbelievable. India had a poor people's strike, poor workers' strike of 110 million people the other day, and nobody even reported it in the United States. So that this is a temporary phenomenon. And as a result of the upsurge that is taking place in China, India, and elsewhere, what is beginning to happen in the United States is that U.S. companies and unions, like the United Auto Workers, are taking measures to preserve the plants in the United States. And one of those measures is to have a two-tier wage system, which is unbelievable. The second measure is that Japanese and European companies are coming to the United States because we're the new third world. We have taken such a beating that it is now possible to actually have an American auto worker make half of what they made before and still survive. Now, that's the first thing. The second thing that's rather important is to remember, and I don't think this is understood very well, is that we still, in the United States, make machinery, high-tech machinery. I don't mean televisions. I don't mean computers. I mean real high-tech machinery. And that has not moved out of this country. But in a place like Caterpillar, which makes earth-moving equipment, and we use a lot of earth-moving equipment in this country, the Caterpillar company has said, you go on strike and we will stay there and wait you out. And they did that with the machinist union in Illinois, in Joliet, Illinois, where the union went on strike for 4 months and settled for a 0-0-0-0-6-0 wage settlement with a one-time gift of $3,000, which is 8 cents an hour over 6 years. Now, what's interesting about that is that we're seeing unions, even what we said before, they're beginning to collapse, even on their own conditions, to try to hold on to the plants. What you don't see is that when the plants move, where is the occupation of the plants? Why aren't they operating garment plants and textile plants and handbag plants and auto plants that have been abandoned? Why don't they make stuff? Why don't they decide, even under capitalism, that they're going to create workers' co-ops and to try to operate
to follow
them.
The Argentinian model?
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
All right. I wish, as always, that we had more time. Thank you very much, Stanley.
You're
welcome. It's very provocative. The labor movement remains an important social force in the United States, something that we have to watch, something that we have to think about, and we can thank Stanley for being a source of important, critical, independent ideas about it for a long time, and I hope it'll be for many more years to come and that you'll come back and be on the program again. In the time that remains, a couple of responses to your questions. One of you asked about college and university finances. Now, we talk about this quite often, but I wanted to hammer a few points in response to one of your questions about why are the finances of college and university so out of whack? Why have they costs, both public and private, gone up so much and so forth? I want to respond with a few specific questions and comments to those concerns that you've articulated. First, do not underestimate, please, the situation we now face with young people and their families in the United States. The job market is a disaster, particularly for people who have the desire to get a white-collar job, a job that would normally require some education beyond high school. Those jobs are difficult to get, and they have frightened a whole sector of the American population that had planned on, expected, and wants to go and get those kinds of jobs. To make a long story short, Americans are more desperate than ever to get a college degree because they believe it will give them a leg up in a difficult job market, give them a leg up on a difficult job future that they face. Whether they're the young people themselves or their parents and relatives who help pay for it, there's a desperation that allows colleges and universities to jack up the prices they charge for what they do because of a buyer population that has to pay. Nothing illustrates that so much as the extraordinary levels of personal debt being accumulated by students and their families to help pay for college education. At a time when the parents' job security is less than it used to be, when the parents' own job prospects are poorer than they used to be, when they already are staggering under mortgage debt, car payment debt, and credit card debt, to be able to, or willing, to undertake yet another kind of debt on top of it, student debt, is extraordinary and a sign that the market is what you might say a seller's market. The sellers of college credit are taking advantage of the market. Number two, it's crucial to understand that for the public sector, where three-quarters of college and university students get their education in the United States, in that sector, support by state legislators, who are the major funders of public higher education, has been falling across the United States in almost every state for years now. And the result is that the budgets of these public colleges and universities has been squeezed. They become desperate for other sources of revenue. And one of the directions they took was to become, if you like, purveyors of all kinds of other activities to generate money. One of the biggest of these, sports. Build a stadium. Build a basketball franchise. Do the things that will make you a sports enterprise alongside of your educational. Oh, yes, you refer to it as the college team. But in point of fact, you're building a stadium, you're developing a team operation, and you're doing it to get the television income you get from it and the attendance from people who will come to see it. And that means resources, energy, focused away from the teaching of the classes and more onto the lucrative form of sports. Next one. To make partnerships with private enterprises, to make deals that bring in money from private enterprise because you're not getting, as a public institution, the support from your state. And the private enterprises demand things in return. And so education becomes more geared to what the company wants and a little less geared to what the faculty and the students and the development of the country as a whole might want. I think that's very important. I think the extraordinary wealth of the top 1 to 10% of Americans means that private schools can charge what they want as well because many of the people they serve have more money than they know what to do with and are willing to pay whatever it takes for the high-quality education, the prestige education. In short, the problems of our colleges and universities are part of a system that doesn't work anymore. The incomes of working people are not enough to pay these prices, so they have to go into debt. The system doesn't provide enough quality jobs for the people it gives an education to, or at least the people who want one, and so the adjustments are made by going further into debt, and on and on and on. We cannot expect our colleges and universities to fix a system that's broken. We can expect what we see, which is that they are more and more reflecting in their own problems the larger economic crises of our time. Another point, that question that came in about something I did last week. I spoke last week about the study of the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, that has been releasing income inequality numbers. And I pointed out the United States was among one of the most unequal countries of the 31 or 34 that the OECD measures. And some of you asked a question, did these numbers reflect the distribution of income before you take into account welfare payments, what we call transfer payments and taxes, or after? Well, I went back and I want to give you the results. What I gave you last time had to do with the position of the United States after taking into account all of the transfers. And I think here there's a little lesson that I might convey by going over it. I'm going to use the example of Ireland. If you take the 31 countries that the OECD reported on, Ireland was the most unequal if you just looked at the private incomes that people got before looking at how taxes and payments by the government changed everything. Ireland went from the most unequal to something very interesting, the most equal. In other words, Ireland really has a system in which it does take money from those who are at the top and transfer it to those who are at the bottom. It becomes one of the most unequal if you don't look at taxes and transfers, but it becomes the most equal. The United States is very interesting. The United States ranks about 10th from the bottom. Not a good record. 10th from the bottom in inequality before you take into account taxes and transfers. After you look at taxes and transfers, the United States becomes worse, the fourth worst inequality. We don't reallocate income and wealth in this country. We don't do it at all. We actually make our unemployment and our inequality worse. This is Richard Wolff. Thank you for spending your time with me. This is Economic Update, and I look forward to speaking with you and meeting with you again next week.
Your time now, baby. But after a while, it's gonna be my time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.